them. And the other, you know, the other three guys will be, well, one guy, they're making him the pilot. He's flown a lot, but the other three guys are paying passengers. From what I understand, it's over $50 million each. So, you know, these people have plenty of money, and should be interesting. One guy's from Ohio. He's a real estate entrepreneur. The other guy, I forget where he's from, but then there's another fella, Eaton Stibble, his name is. He's originally from Israel. He used to fly fighter jets and things over there. But now, you know, now he's a multimillionaire. And he'll be flying on it. The interesting thing I read about him was when he was younger, and, you know, flying in the military in Israel, one of his commanders was Eon Ramon. This guy Ramon was the first fellow from Israel to actually be an astronaut. He was one of the people that was on Columbia, on the Columbia mission, that, you know, STS-107, that's the one that disintegrated coming back to Earth in 2003. So, but this guy, he was really taught by Eon, and now here he is all these years later, and he's gonna go up. I thought that was pretty cool. Anyway, they're gonna go for 10 days and dock with the International Space Station. NASA has approved this. They made arrangements to be guinea pigs, you know, for medical purposes, and they're going to do some scientific experiments up there. But this is all being arranged by Axiom. Axiom is a company that's presently building at least three, but they're going to start off with one module that they plan to attach to the front end of the International Space Station. It will eventually be berthed to the Harmony module. And then they'll extend that, you know, to two other modules over, you know, over the coming years. But that's Axiom's idea. And then most of Axiom's people, which will be private paying customers like this, will be going up and staying in those modules. You know, I mean, they'll float through the International Space Station and go through all the 15 different modules that are there, but they'll have their own. And as the years go by, right now, the Biden administration has just extended the life of the International Space Station to at least 2030. You know, they were thinking about, you know, ending it. I remember years ago they said 2024, 2028. Anyway, it's going to be at least 2030. But at some point, you know, they'll get to the point where they get rid of the space station, and eventually it will be taken over. You'll have other space stations up there, private space stations. Not to mention, from, you know, other companies, other countries like China. We already have one up there now with three people in their own Tiangong space station. But Axiom plans on eventually taking their three modules with their own big, huge solar panels and everything, and that will be attached to it and separate from the ISS and become their own floating space station. So this is the first of many missions. That's why they're calling it Axiom 1. So I thought that was pretty interesting. None of them are hams. I thought maybe the commander was, but I couldn't find anything on him. Let me drop it. Put a fan on my radio here. Now you have another crew that's going to be going up. They're going to be up there for 10 days, so end of March, 10 days, and then 10 days later, they'll be coming back, let's say, on the 10th or the 11th. On the 5th, the 10th or 11th of April, they'll be coming back. But now, April 15th, 5 days after they come back, you're going to have another crew that's going to be launched on another Falcon 9 crew vehicle on another SpaceX shot to the space station. And this time, they're bringing four actual NASA astronauts. And, of course, you know, when they dock, they're staying, I'm not going to say forever, but they're staying for 6 months. That's usually the time that the crews stay on the space station, minimum of 6 months nowadays. You have Joe Lindgren. He's the commander, and he is a ham. KO5MOS, along with another ham from Italy, Samantha Christopher Eddy. She's been up there before a number of times. From the European Space Agency, and she's got a call letter of IZ0UDF. And when they make contacts with the school up there, they don't use their own call. They just use the ISS call. So that's what they always do. Same with the Russians and the European Space Agency. You know, they are. They could have call letters, but they're always using the call letters on board the space station. The other two going up are Robert Hines and Jessica Watkins. I couldn't find any call letters on them. So 50% of that mission will have amateur radio operators on board. And they'll be going up for a six-month stay. Four people that are up there now will eventually be coming back. There you go. Looking at the time. All right, we got past 11 o'clock. Well, that's okay. I just wanted to mention there is a rocket going up tomorrow, hopefully. Another attempt by Astra. Astra is going to launch this very small rocket, but they're going to go to orbit. They've done it once before. It's only a 45-foot tall rocket, only 2 feet diameter. It's got five Delphi engines attached to it, and they plan on making it to orbit. They've done it once before. They launched from Kodiak, Alaska, last November. It took them four tries, but the fourth try, the rocket did make it to orbit. This one's going to have four CubeSats attached to it, one of which is from NASA. And hopefully they make it to orbit. It'll be the shortest rocket that will have that capability if they make it. Anyway, they're launching from Launch Complex 46 down in Florida. NASA gave them permission to do that. So, it's the same idea what NASA did for SpaceX. You know, they would start getting contracts with SpaceX to make it to space. So when they started, Elon Musk, it took him four shots to do it. Eventually, he got the Falcon 1 rocket up to space. Falcon 1 rocket had, at the time, a 100,000-pound thrust. So that was quite large compared to this. It was around 75 feet tall. This thing's only 45 feet tall. And it only has like 35,000 pounds of thrust, but plenty of fuel in it to, it does have a second stage get this small payload, a couple hundred pounds, to a 41 degree inclination. They tried to make it yesterday, but nothing with the rocket is, it had a ground support problem with one of the radars. But they would have had a little difficulty in tracking it. So they rescheduled it for Monday in the afternoon. So if you're retired, you can watch a replay on YouTube or something. But see if they make it up there. If they do it, they plan on having many, many flights. The idea is to drive the cost down, and that's what they're doing. Down to, you know, like SpaceX with the $62 million per launch, and the thing maybe could do with, you know, maybe $5 or $10 million. We'll see. See how Astra is the name of the company, how they do. Any questions or comments before I sign? This is WS2N. Okay. Thank everybody that stood by and listened. Thank Ed for great comments and questions. And I'll see, tomorrow night is the Club Net. And that comes on at 8:30, not 8 o'clock like this net. And that'll be on these repeaters, followed by the Swap and Shop with George Katie2. How about you? You heard earlier tonight. And I hope his power supply gets back to normal. And, if not, you know, we heard him pretty good. So we should be able to hear George tomorrow night. And that's followed by Newsline. Well, I'll turn it over to you, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS, thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net, and thank you for all that you do for the club. Everyone does appreciate it. And I want to thank everyone once again who participated tonight. The more people participate, the more different subjects we can get into and discuss and learn more about. So please keep it up. I just want to remind people once again that if you want to reach me via mail, either for mailbag questions, topics for discussion, puzzle, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to directly communicate with Paul, you can reach him by spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, keep in mind that I have a list of interesting articles, and there's an image of a radio wave picture of the cosmos, which is kind of interesting. So please take a look at the link page at your convenience. All you have to do is type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com. That'll bring you the link page. If you want to listen to the audio stream of Glen Oaks, it's available 24/7. Type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And always keep in mind Mike KC2NJI's great archive site. He has amateur radio.tv, over a million visitors, and he is the keeper of the archives that go back for the technical net all the way to September of 2006. So keep that in mind. And as I always like to end these sessions in similar way to the way Dick K2RIW did, he suggested to be kind to each other. Please, that's good advice in general. It's great advice right now. Be safe, be smart, protect each other, and try not to annoy people. You know, it's a hobby. You're supposed to have fun. So everyone have a great week. Stay warm, stay dry, and please come back next Sunday night at 8 o'clock when we'll try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I am formally closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net, and I am clear.
KD2FRU Portable, thanks, Roy. Thanks, Paul. It was the PowerWorks 25 that failed.
Okay, George. Is it repairable? Whatever you're using is working now, but you're just not as loud as before. Is it a different radio?
I'm on a Yaesu FT60 by the front window in my house. So, hey, thanks for coming back, man. I got another power supply. I don't have to worry about that to get on tomorrow night. And 7-3, thank you guys so much. Thanks.
Have a good one, George. 73. Ed, are you still there? WB2EAV, WS2N.
WB2EAV.
Yeah, you were talking about the glide slopes on airplanes before, three degrees. Remember the shuttle, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with this. The shuttle would come down like at 20 degrees, you know. But they wouldn't hit the ground at 20 degrees. They called it flaring up at the end. The nose would come up, and that would somehow, I guess, slow it down. You know, that would help slow it down. But at the same time, it used to bring it into, they said like 1.5 degrees. So even less than the 3 degrees. Which I guess it was a good thing. Well, they were coming in over 200 miles an hour. I forget what a big jet comes in. Now I know it's not over 200. I wonder if you have any comments on that. Back to you, Trent.
Oh, yeah, several. You ready?
Go ahead, Ed.
First of all, they said that the shuttle... The aerodynamics of the shuttle on landing were a perfect match for a falling brick, which is obviously an exaggeration, but yeah, it was steep, and remember, it's dead stick. You get one chance. There's no such thing as a go-around. And yeah, it was steep, and it was abusive. Now, for standard of reference, airliners descend down to the runway at 3 degrees, and then they do a flare, where basically the glide slope asymptotically approaches zero, so you have, in theory, have a nice, gentle hit. In other words, they allow, I guess, about 500 feet on the runway from where you're aiming at to where you actually, you know, touch down, and the idea is to make as smooth and asymptotic approach as possible. Now, standard of reference. Planes land on the deck of an aircraft carrier at a 4-degree glide slope with no flare at all. And it is brutal. It is bone-jarring. And so I assume that the shuttle would hit somewhere in, you know, somewhere approaching, but not as much as landing on the deck of the carrier.
Very good. Okay, I thought you would know that. And, there's this other spacecraft that comes back from space every year and a half or so. It's the X-37B, and it looks like a small shuttle. And, of course, it's unmanned. You know, it goes up. It does work for the Defense Department, military, a lot of top-secret stuff. And then eventually comes back after... I think the last one stayed up 700 days. Anyway, there's two of these X-37Bs. They'll fly one, and then eventually, you know, when that comes back, they'll fly another one. But I've seen the glide slope on that. When it comes in, I mean, it looks like it's coming in like the shuttle, but I don't know. I don't see this thing flaring at all. But maybe it is. I just can't see it. But boy, that thing comes in and just lands. I mean, it lands on a mark every time. The earlier flights, they used to land in California, but now they fly it, land back in Florida on that 3-mile runway, which they have plenty of runway. No problem there. Back to you, Ed.
Yeah, but the idea is, like, except for landing on an aircraft carrier, you want to do a flare. And also, the so-called ground effect is a tremendous help. There is actually a problem with a small plane that the wings interact with the ground, and sometimes you literally can actually have problems getting the plane to go get down the last few feet to the ground. You know, a small plane. But... Like I said, the standard of reference is 4 degrees, no flare to an aircraft carrier, and that is as bad as you want to get. Anything more than that, there's going to be problems. You know, carrier-based planes have a lifetime. they have to be scrapped after a certain number of carrier landings because it's that abusive on the airframe.
Okay. I can't imagine the strain that's put on a fuselage when the hooks grab. And from what I understand, they're coming down full throttle because if they miss, they gotta be going fast enough to take off again. So that must put some strain on the whole fuselage, I would imagine, the whole frame.
Let me say this. I know this stuff. No, I have never done it. I worked on a system that was installed having to do with the landing systems on aircraft carriers, and we spent 3 weeks on the USS Ranger in San Diego Harbor. No, we slept in a hotel nearby, but, we spent 3 weeks working every day on the air traffic control center of an aircraft carrier, talking to the air traffic controllers and the pilots whenever we weren't busy. So I learned it. I learned an entire college education on this subject. That's where I'm coming from. The planes come down at a standard 135 knots. And what they do is it's a little bit hot, but it's not ridiculously so. It's called dirty up. Gears down, tail hook down, flaps down, 135 knots, 40 degree glide slope. Now what happens is when they hit the deck with a bone jarring crash, they go to full throttle immediately and hopefully the tail hook catches the arresting cables and they're sitting there sheepishly at a dead stop with the engine screaming. The alternative is you hope that the thing spools up enough, because remember, these things don't have that high acceleration, on the engines. They have to spool up. So you hope you spooled up to enough power to do a clean takeoff when you roll off the front.
Yeah, okay. I would imagine these pilots have plenty of practice on land first, being able to get, do it. They must have a system, I would imagine. Of course, a boat is different. It's moving. But I would imagine they have these arrestor wires that are going to grab it. And for that matter, they probably practice with the takeoff ones. They were for years steam-powered, and now I understand they're using magnets. Linear magnet system. But I would imagine they have this probably where you are on land, right?
I believe every word you said is absolutely true. I do not have first-hand experience there. But I will tell you, you are not landing on a carrier called Turkey. It's obvious you build up to that by playing on land a lot. Now, you also brought the subject, the steam catapults and the Gerald Ford, the new carrier, has new electromagnetic catapults. I know nothing, but I think I understand it. You want to hear my theory?
Okay. I know a lot about steam-powered stuff, but not about the. I know that there was steam power that would launch that. But go ahead. I'll listen to your theory. Ed.
I believe a steam catapult is pretty much one size fits all. You hook your plane up, the thing flings you off into space, and you go. Now here's a problem. Let's say you have a relatively small fighter jet. And let's say you're not going very far. Like when they bring a carrier into port, while they're still out at sea, they fly all the planes off who land nearby. So you take a plane, that has no weapons, no point in using a full fuel load, it's flying relatively light. Now you compare that to the same fighter, or maybe even a bigger fighter, or a bigger plane at all, with say like a E-2 radar plane, or a C-2 cargo plane, you all get the same push. And I can see the reason why they went to electromagnetic is you can have an acceleration profile. And it might even vary with the plane and the load. So like a C-2, you know, cargo plane flying empty might get one profile. A C-2 carrying full rated load might get another profile. You know, F-18 lightly loaded might have a different profile. An F-18 with a full combat load and full tanks might have another profile. And I think they can optimize it, which is totally out of the question this season.
Very interesting. Okay. I've seen a couple of shows about the magnetic system, but they never talked about having a... Yeah, I can see that. You know, you put it into the computer somewhere. We're launching F-18s that are fully loaded today. You know, and the whole thing is just set for that. And then out comes a cargo, and they can instantly change it to a different different pull on the vehicle itself. When it goes, very good. Okay, I'm going to sign. Say 73. And I like listening to your stories. Great stories. And I'm going to have a good night. I'm going to say 73. WB2EAB, WS2.
Let me make one last point. The key point is, with an electromagnetic system, you can monitor the aircraft progress and tweak it to maintain the profile, which is completely out of the question to Steve. Again, I know nothing, but I know I could design an electromagnetic launch system like this, given enough time and money, and I can't believe that they're not doing just that.
Understood. Okay, yeah, well, you take a high-pressure steam system and they probably have blowout discs. I wouldn't be surprised, but I would imagine you're only going to get one pressure, you know, 300 PSI or something, and that's going to be it. I can't see them changing it for different airplanes or different loads. But yeah, the magnetic ones I could. Okay, Ed, have a good night. We'll catch you next week, if not sooner. This is WS2N. Have a good one.
Okay, Paul, hope I've been of some help. I actually enjoy this immensely. With that, WB2EAV, we'll be clear.
Okay, so do I. WS2N clear.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
KA2YHY listening.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
IK4UON.
Sigil, this is Italy, Kilowatt 4, Uniform Oscar, November calling. Sigil, this is Italy, Kilowatt 4, Uniform Oscar, November calling. Over.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
FIU, portable. KD2FIU, portable.
KD2FIU, KD2OGB mobile.
Morning, Craig. How you doing, man?
Not really in the best of my flavor. As usual, on my way to Babylon. I can't get my computer to connect to the Wi-Fi despite the signal being very strong and resetting the router multiple times, but my phone connects and everything else, just not the computer.
Even though you went in and set up the network in the PC with the right address?
Yeah, it should be. I even reset the adapter through the computer, like hitting the diagnose, and that's not fixing it. I'm having my mom trying to figure out the problem and my brother while I'm out, but if I can't, then I don't know what I could do. I mean, the extra piece that actually gives me the extendable range for my Wi-Fi is typically attached to my computer. Other than without that, the signal gets a little weaker, and so maybe I might have to get something a little stronger that can probably reach it.
Oh, okay, so it's not a matter of it being the address and the password.
So it's not the address or the password. It says just can't connect to the network, and that's it, yet the password is right, and the Wi-Fi signal is, like, at its highest, strongest point.
Yeah. I can't help with that because that's something you got to play with. You got to have your hands on it. Anyhow, hey, I'm working in HT from my QTH. Can you hear me well?
Sounds pretty good. I'm going to go park in Babylon, so I'll say 7-3s. Other than that, you are very great with your HTs, so I'm going to go park 7-3s. KD2FIU, KD2OGV Mobile, clear at Babylon.
7-3, Craig. Thanks for picking up, and have a good day, man. Bye-bye. KD2FIU Portable is clear.
This is KD2UDU listening. W2OSR. How you doing, Bob? It's KD2UDU.
Okay, is it your lunchtime again?
Yes, sir. I normally go 11:30 to like quarter after 12, 45 minutes.
Yeah, when I was working and I was going into the city, I used to try and get out a little bit early for lunch to beat the crowds that I could get in and out quickly.
Yeah, roger that. I normally bring lunch, but I like to warm it up, and there's only two microwaves in the cafeteria, and if I wait till 12 o'clock, there's a line. So I go earlier, and if I'm going to go buy lunch, there, you know, like you said, it's better to go early.
Okay, W2OSR. Let me see if it chirped.
Yeah, that's better.
Now, speaking about microwaves, you remind me of something. Guy that was the vice president of our company was in the cafeteria, and there was something wrong with the coffee machine. It made coffee, but it wasn't hot. So he's sitting there scratching his head. I said, why don't you just stick it in the microwave and warm it up? It was sort of like the light bulb went off.
Befuddled, right? as long as you don't put it in a pot that has a metal band around it, it's not a problem.
Well, at that point, I think it was in one of those paper coffee cups.
I'm surprised you didn't think of that. I mean, I warm up my buttered roll sometimes in the morning because it's cold from being in the refrigerator.
Yeah, I do that all the time. Sometimes we'll have waffles and English muffins in the morning for breakfast. And the butters just come out of the refrigerator and it's as hard as a rock. And the toast or the waffles aren't quite warm enough to melt it. So I'll stick it in the microwave for 25 seconds just to melt the butter.
Yeah, they do have their uses. I mean, for defrosting. You know, as far as cooking things, at least a little will be desired, but warming things up, they're perfect.
Yeah, now that we have one, it makes me wonder what we did before we had one.
Yeah, this is KD2UDU. Yeah, I can't remember not having one. I've had them so long.
I'm W2OSR. Yeah, we had the kitchen remodeled. When my wife first got married, I already owned a house. And she said, don't buy me an engagement ring, but get me a new kitchen. So we had somebody come in and put cabinets to the kitchen, and we reconfigured the kitchen so it was easier to live in. Getting to be close to 20 years ago, we had it redone again with better quality cabinets.
I see your wife as a practical woman.
Oh, yeah, and she didn't balk when I said, well, don't buy me a wedding ring because I can't wear it. I've got skin that reacts to gold.
Yeah, I choose not to wear one myself. I actually had one cut off me once because I jumped off a boat and it got caught on the side of the boat and caused a nice laceration to my finger. So ever since then, I have one, but I don't wear it because I deal with heavy machinery during the day, and I don't want a reboot of that issue.
Yeah, I can understand that. I've done lots of electrical and electronic work almost all my life. And, you know, actually it's a little bit safer not having a ring on your finger, especially working around high voltage. Or microwave RF, because both of those can cause quite serious burns on the ring finger.
Believe it. Definitely a hazard.
Now, right now I'm on the way to the post office to get stamps. Because when I paid the bills last week, we didn't have any left.
It was a problem with me. You know, my wife is retired now, so she's making the post office run today. Anyway, are you going to the meeting? I just saw a email from Mike saying the meeting's at Lannan House tonight.
Yeah, I was on the air last night in the where Mike kind of runs a little bit of a class for some of the newer Morse code operators to get them on the air, and he said we're going to have it at the meeting house tonight, so that's where I'll be.
I'm not sure. I have a doctor's appointment, so we'll have to see if I can make it out there.
Maybe we'll see you later. I'm at the post office, W2OSR.
Bob, we'll catch you later. This is KD2UDU.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Delta 2 Alpha Mike Zulu, KD2 AMZ, mobile.
This is WIW testing, testing.
This is KD2WIW testing, using crossband repeat on my mobile rig and a Redivis RT82 handheld unit in my car from Hickville, Long Island.
This is KD2TXI. Yeah, you're coming in very clearly. Nice work.
Station, come back again. Say that one more time, please.
This is KD2TXI, and I'm hearing you clearly.
Hey, thank you very much for the comeback, and I appreciate it. Just sitting here on lunch at work and just playing around a little bit. I've been researching the crossband repeat modes on my on a couple mobile rigs that I have actually. My Yaesu has it, and this Anytone that I have mounted up in the car has it also, so I'm starting to use it a little bit more often now.
Copy that. It's sounding really good. Which Anytone model do you have?
Don't quote me on this, but I think I am almost 100% sure it's a Anytone 5888UV3. And the UV3 is the tri-band version, so it has that 220. But, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's a 5888UV3. It's sort of like the Yaesu FT8800, which is the other mobile rig that I have that does crossband, but it's kind of similar in the way that it has kind of two radios in one screen. So it has a channel and a B channel basically, with separate volume knobs and separate selector knobs.
Copy that. The crossband seems like a good thing to have. Which of the radios do you like better?
Well, I've been using the Anytone in my car for probably over 6 months now, and the Yaesu I just got probably 2 weeks ago. So I've been playing with the Yaesu in my room a little bit in my little ham shack. Eventually that rig is meant to go into my truck. I have a center console that I'm putting CB in and a dual band radio and switches for lights and stuff like that. But the Yaesu is eventually going to go into my truck, but I've been using it in my room, and it's very, very similar. It's honestly hard to tell the difference. Honestly, the Yaesu, if anything, people have said that my voice, like the volume of my voice is lower, so I might have to take apart the mic and drill a hole where there's these three little tiny, super tiny little mic slots in the case. So I might actually just take apart the case and drill that out. Maybe I'll get a little bit better audio from that. But other than that, they're very similar radios, and they both work very well from what I've seen so far. KD2WIW.
Copy that. Thanks for the info. I was actually looking into getting something similar and was just beginning my research, so that's helpful. Thanks. This is KD2TXI.
Okay, very good. Glad I can help you in that sense. If you are, let me ask you a question. Are you looking to do a dual band radio or a quad band? Because both the Anytone and the, actually I think the TYT is the copy of the Yaesu, but they do have the Yaesu 8800, which is the dual band, and the 9800, which is the quad band, and TYT makes a copy of that 9800, which is also a quad band radio. So yeah, are you looking for quad band or just dual band?
Well, thanks for the info. That's really helpful. Yeah, it's a lot to learn and a lot of research.
problem, buddy. That's what we're here for. And, yeah, all right. Well, I was going to say, if you were looking for quad band, there is another brand. I don't know how you would want to pronounce it. I pronounce it Wuxin. I know some people call it Ocean or Wuxin or whatever, but Wuxin makes another radio, mobile radio, that I was looking at that has the same features. It's a AB channel kind of radio where they have two, it's basically two separate radios in one package. And that one, you know, I'm going to look it up right now so I can get the name for you, but that radio was a close, if I didn't buy the Yaesu, I probably would have went and bought this one brand new, because this radio looks real nice. It's a Wuxin, it's a quad band, and I'm not sure if they make a dual band version of it. If they do, then I'm probably going to end up grabbing that one day, because it'll probably be cheaper. The quad band that I'm talking about from Wuxin, I think, is upwards of $300. So, give me a sec, I'll bring it up, and I'll tell you what the radio name is.
82 at KX with a comment.
Station, go ahead with your comment. This is KD2WIW.
WIW, KD2 at KX. Just keep in mind, a lot of those mobile quad band radios that do 2 meter, 440, 220, and 10 meters, the 10 meter band is only open for FM only.
Other station, did you hear that? The 10 meter band is open for FM only. And that's actually good to know, so thank you for that, because I was looking into maybe doing some 10 meter, and I don't know, I've been doing a little bit of research on that too. That's why I was looking into the quad band radios. I decided to go with the dual band because that's really all I use right now, and I probably will use for probably the next couple months to a year, but I was looking at the quad band radios and trying to do some research on those, so thank you for the info.
No problem. I ran into that problem. My wife was nice enough one year for Christmas to get me the quad band radio. And I looked at it, and I'm like, I love it. It's great. It does, you know, 2 meters, 440, 220, but 10 meters FM? I don't, you know, not a very popular band on FM. Most of the times it's sideband. So I sent it back and put a couple of bucks towards it, and I picked up the Yaesu 857. I don't know if that model's still available, but that's an all-mode 6 through 10, 2 meter 440, great mobile radio.
This is KD2TXI. Thank you for the info. What was the model of that last radio you mentioned?
That would be the FT-857, which I don't think is still available, but they may have a replacement for it. And, of course, there's the bigger brother on that would be the 897, and I think that's been replaced with the 991. Not sure 100%, but if you're looking for a all-band, multi-band radio, the Yaesus are the best. I love them.
Thank you so much for that information. This is KD2TXI.
KD2WIW, and yeah, the 857 is a nice radio. I was actually looking at the 891, the FT891. The only problem is it was way out of my budget, so that'll be a buy for the future. I want to make a little bit more money, but Yaesu radios are the best. I specifically like their handhelds. I have the FT4XR and the